Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for attending today's program. My name is Peter Gerlach, and I am ICFRC's Executive Director. Before turning the program over to our host, I'm excited to share that after our speaker's presentation and before the Q&A, we will be giving 5 minutes to a special guest, Mr. Andrei Kamenchikov, the Ukrainian representative for the U.S.-based NGO Nonviolence International. Andrei, we are very excited you could be here today. And with that, I will turn things over to you, Bill.
Thanks, Peter. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring Dr. Maria Popova on the topic of Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, those of you who are in person and those who are watching live stream. My name is Bill Reisinger. I'm an ICFRC board member, and I'll be your host for today's program. This year marks ICFRC's 40th anniversary. We are celebrating our supporters, our legacy in the community, and the bright future ahead for internationally focused programming in Iowa City. Check out our website, sign up for our monthly newsletters, and follow us on social media to learn more about the exciting events happening this year. ICFRC is very grateful to our sponsors and partners, including the following: the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxes Plus, City Channel 4, which provides online access to our programs along with the UI Library Archives, and of course, the Iowa City Public Library for their partnership, providing our new home, and for the refreshments being served today. I'm also happy to take this opportunity to say how much ICFRC appreciates all its donors. Thank you to those who are in the audience today. As a small nonprofit, we are primarily funded by the generosity of individuals. If you are not a donor this year, I hope you will consider making a financial contribution by scanning one of the QR codes in the room or by visiting our website, which is icfrc.org. ICFRC has adopted the Native American Land Acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Human Rights Commission. ICFRC recognizes that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homelands of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. The full text of ICFRC's acknowledgement is on our website at icfrc.org. So now let me introduce our speaker today. Maria Popova is an associate professor of political science at McGill University, the scientific director of the Jean Monnet Center Montreal, and editor of the Cambridge Elements series on politics and society from Central Europe to Central Asia. Her work explores the rule of law and democracy in Eastern Europe. Her first book, Politicized Justice in Emerging Democracies, won the American Association for Ukrainian Studies Book Prize in 2013. It examines the weaponization of law to manipulate elections and control the media in Russia and Ukraine. Her second book, co-authored with Oksana Shevel and with the same title as today's talk, just came out last month to the kind of excellent reviews that make fellow academics jealous. Michael McFaul of Stanford, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, says, if you only have time to read one book on the origins of contemporary conflict between Russia and Ukraine, this is the book to read. Serhii Plokhii of Harvard, the preeminent expert on Ukrainian history, calls the book a must-read for anyone who wants to understand the origins of the largest military conflict in Europe since World War II. So we're very fortunate to get a sample of the book's insights today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Maria Popova, who will talk about Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. Maria?
Thank you very much, Bill, for this kind introduction. And thank you to everyone who is in the room watching, everybody who's online. Let me start by sharing the slides. Okay, great. So today I'm going to speak about the book that Oksana Shevel and I wrote last year. We started writing soon after the beginning of the full-scale invasion. And we were motivated by a simple question or a set of questions. And those were, why did Russia end up launching this full-scale invasion, going straight for Kyiv, trying to take over the Ukrainian state? And why did Ukraine and Ukrainians resist so vigorously and so effectively, as it turns out? So in order to do that, we went back to the last 30 years. In the book, we go a bit farther back into history, because undoubtedly the history of Russia and Ukraine's entanglement goes way back and could be started at various different points. But we went back really to the end of the Soviet Union. And in the book, we argue that really the way in which the Soviet Union collapsed is the origins of this collision course that we now see play out in a full-out war. What we argue is that the Soviet Union, the understanding of the collapse of the Soviet Union and what that meant, was misaligned from the very start between Ukraine and Russia. You may be familiar with the famous phrase of the first Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, who called the dissolution of the Soviet Union, in which he played an absolutely integral part by signing the Belovezha Accords, he called it a civilized divorce. But sticking sort of to the marriage metaphor, what we argue and what we try to show in the book is that for Russia, not just for Yeltsin, but for broadly, more broadly for Russian elites, really the dissolution of the Soviet Union was not the complete end of the idea of common statehood, but a rewriting of the vows of sorts. The idea that Russia and Ukraine would continue to be tied together into some common form of a state potentially, but that basis has to be sort of re-examined. And what we argue is that this misalignment of understanding launched an escalatory cycle between Ukrainian commitment to the independence that they received in 1991 and Russia's commitment to re-imperialize the area in some way, in some shape or form. And it's an escalatory cycle because the more that Russia pushed to re-imperialize, the more Ukraine committed to its independence. But the more Ukraine committed to its independence, the more it intensified in Russia ambitions and commitment to figure out an effective way to re-imperialize. And this kind of cycle gradually produced significant divergence between Russia and Ukraine on three dimensions: on identity, on regime type, eventually on geopolitical orientation. And it's crucial here for me to emphasize that what we argue in the book and try to show is that the identity and regime divergence between Russia and Ukraine not only preceded the geopolitical divergence, but were really much more important to the collision course between the two countries than the geopolitical divergence that happened in the later period, and which tends to be discussed probably more than the identity and regime divergence. Now, let me try to illustrate the identity divergence first with some data. So we start with this idea that in the beginning, Russia and Ukraine start out with their own sort of different versions of how to interpret and how to identify their own nations and the relationship between those nations and the states that they're occupying. And in Ukraine's case, independence starts with two competing identity conceptions for Ukrainians themselves. On the one hand, we have an identity conception that emphasizes the distinctiveness of the Ukrainian nation as any other from the Russian nation, as any other nation in the European family of nations, and a nation that has now finally obtained its own independent state. That was one identity conception. The other identity conception was of Ukrainians as part of the tri-national unity of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine as three Slavic brotherly nations that belong to a sort of Slavic supranational civilization. This kind of identity conception was the Russian identity conception all along from the very start. But in Ukraine, there was sort of a roughly half the country subscribing to this national identity as well. However, what we see from the very start of independent statehood is an interesting political coalition that forms. And it's a political coalition that has been called the Grand Bargain, which is a coalition at the elite level between two groups of elites. On the one hand, we have the national democratic elites, those who ideologically subscribe to the distinctive national identity project and want to emphasize Ukraine's distinctiveness from Russia. The other side of this coalition are communist nomenclatura elites who are not particularly ideologically committed to this idea of a distinctive nation, but they would like to govern an independent state. So they're committed to the idea of Ukraine becoming or continuing to be an independent state. And these two groups form a coalition, using this grand bargain. And they have, at that point, from the very start, a majority in the Ukrainian parliament. And they start pursuing all sorts of identity fostering or identity related policies, language policies, citizenship policies, historical memory policies. We go over those in the book extensively, and we see that over time, these policies start moving the identity, the dominant identity conception within not only the elites, but the masses, but in a consistent direction where gradually a larger proportion of the Ukrainian electorate identifies with the distinctive identity idea and the policies that are needed to buttress it. So what we see here on this graph that I'm showing is how Ukrainians' commitment to an independent Ukrainian state grows over time. Specifically, this is not a question about should we be independent. This is a question which says, what do you consider yourself? And there's a lot of options in that question. So the goal is to capture the primary identification that a person has. So the options are things like I identify as a citizen of my city, of my region, of Europe, of the Soviet Union, and one of the options is a citizen of Ukraine. And what you see is that this identification starts grows consistently throughout the last 30 years. And you will also notice that there are specific points in which this type of identification grows in sort of jumps and leaps. And the first date that you may notice is around 2004 or 5. So this is right after the Orange Revolution, a really critical juncture in Ukraine's political development for many reasons, both for identity and for regime reasons. And we then see an even more significant jump in 2014 after Euromaidan, after the beginning of Russia's aggression against Ukraine, and then a really skyrocketing jump after the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 22, when basically the Ukrainian identity, identification with the Ukrainian state is crowding out all of the other possible identities. And I'll point out here for context that when this type of question is asked in any European country, you will see that the numbers are, you know, that people identify very often with their locality primarily rather than with their state. So, so I'm pointing this out so you don't think that 50% or 64% is somehow a low percentage. There are actually six, seven options there. So let me illustrate the identity divergence with another significant change over time. Here you see a divergence in memory politics, which is a crucial part of Ukraine's distinctive self-identity conception. Here, people are asked whether they think that the Holodomor was the genocide of the Ukrainian people. And as you may know, during the Soviet period, it was not allowed to even talk about the Holodomor. And in the post-Soviet period, there is a huge disagreement in how between Russia and Ukraine in how the Holodomor is interpreted. The preponderance of scientific evidence is that the Holodomor was indeed a genocide of the Ukrainian people, but the Russian state is interpreting it as a common tragedy of the Russian and Ukrainian people, a result of bad planning by the Soviet regime. But you can see that in Ukraine, very gradually, but very consistently, we see a growing proportion of the population. By the 2020s, an overwhelming majority of the population perceiving this historical event as the genocide of the Ukrainian people. So not a divided story, a divided Ukraine kind of picture, but in fact, a consistent increase of consensus around a distinctive Ukrainian identity interpretation. Another way to illustrate this is through the use of the language and the perception of which language is your native language. And you can see here that this also consistently changes over time as more and more people identify as Ukrainian speakers and more people report that they speak Ukrainian at home. Now, this the speaking part changes later, but identifying your native language as Ukrainian changes earlier. So what that shows is that really, even though people considered Ukrainian to be their native language, Russian was still a very dominant language in the country. And in fact, the move away from speaking Russian has been very slow and very gradual. Now, the other dimension of divergence between Russia and Ukraine in these 30 years is the regime divergence. And that's also a very significant part of why the two countries eventually end up on this collision course. And in the Ukrainian, I mean, the first graph with the different presidents is kind of a tongue-in-cheek illustration of a very clear difference between Ukraine and Russia and Belarus. You see that Russia and Belarus, in both of these countries, there was no incumbent president lost an election, whereas in Ukraine, every single incumbent president, except for Kuchma, who managed to win two terms, has lost re-election. So political competition has been a mainstay of Ukrainian politics really since the beginning. But there are two very significant critical junctures in the development of Ukrainian democratic politics over the last 30 years. The first one is the Orange Revolution in 2004. And it's a critical juncture because it absolutely could have turned out differently from how it did. Basically, if Yushchenko had actually died from the poisoning during the campaign, it is likely that Yanukovych could have won the election truly against a less popular opponent than Yushchenko. And then we would have had potentially a very plausible counterfactual of Ukrainian democracy failing in 2004. Failing because, as we know from Yanukovych's later term in the 2010s, he pursued autocratization from the get-go, and he may have succeeded in 2004 without the precedent that the Orange Revolution was of mass popular mobilization against manipulated elections. Without the precedent of that mobilization succeeding, it is plausible to hypothesize that Yanukovych may have consolidated an authoritarian regime in Ukraine with Russia's help fairly quickly after 2004. If that had happened in 2004, we would see a relationship between Russia and Ukraine similar to the Russia-Belarus relationship. It's much more difficult for two authoritarian regimes to work together. They would have been both sort of helping each other in various ways. Russia would be helping through energy and through sponsoring, Ukrainian oligarchs would have been buttressing the authoritarian Yanukovych regime. So this may have been, or could have been, the end of the political divergence. This is, however, not what happened. Yushchenko did manage to win the election, and the massive popular mobilization by his supporters and the decision of the Supreme Court to examine the evidence of electoral manipulation and cancel the manipulated second round, cancel the results of them, and order a rerun of the third round of the second round. So a third round resulted in Yushchenko becoming president. And this was a crucial precedent for Ukrainian democracy because after Yushchenko's presidency, there is an entrenchment of competitive elections and free media and freedom of assembly in Ukraine, which sort of switches Ukraine from what it was before, a competitive authoritarian regime where some presidents lost election, but there was constant sort of manipulation of the playing field in favor of the incumbent. We have, after Yanukovych's tenure, free elections. Thereafter, not manipulated. That's why Yanukovych wins them in 2010, because manipulation was no longer on the table. And so over time, Ukrainian democracy moves towards a better functioning democracy, although there are many problems in it in terms of the way that it functions. For example, corruption is hard to root out. Yushchenko does not actually make a lot of headway in that direction. Rule of law reforms are very hard to implement. We go over that in the book in quite some detail. And that's another area in which the Yushchenko administration doesn't make a lot of progress. But then we have in 2010 to 13, Yanukovych's consistent autocratization policies. This is the second point at which the divergence between Russia and Ukraine could have been bridged in some sort of way. If Yanukovych had managed to somehow wait Euromaidan out or suppress it in some sort of way where his entire coalition doesn't implode and lead to his to him leaving the country, which is what happened eventually in Euromaidan. Imagine if he had managed to actually wait out the protest and continue his autocratization attempts. Then it's possible to imagine a counterfactual where, again, Ukraine may have sort of reoriented more decisively towards Russia, thus avoiding the later confrontation. This is, however, again, not what happened. We saw that after the violent attempt to suppress Euromaidan, the Yanukovych coalition simply fell apart. His own security services, the army, his own party in parliament basically imploded in the last few days of Euromaidan, and he left the country and was replaced by parliament in this very ad hoc way, but still following parliamentary procedure. Ad hoc because, of course, no constitution in the world actually has a constitutional provision spelled out for what to do if a president simply leaves the country and leaves his office. So the Ukrainian parliament stepped in as the only functioning political institution and replaced him with an interim president and called new elections, which were then also free and fair, like the previous Ukrainian elections since 2004. But Euromaidan could have been this opportunity for bridging the divergence between Russia and Ukraine, but instead it became really the moment at which divergence, significant divergence for the first time, leads to Russian aggression. And this is the moment at which Russia escalates the attempts to re-imperialize and tie Ukraine back to itself. It escalates the methods through to military intervention, first in Crimea and then by fostering an insurgency in eastern Donbas. And however, the rest of Ukraine that is not occupied by Russia in the post-Euromaidan period makes another leap towards stronger democratic governance, this time aided by European Union conditionality. Ukraine signs the association agreement, which Yanukovych tried to scuttle when he, that was the whole reason for Euromaidan, right? He did not sign the association agreement. Eventually, the association agreement is signed, and it's the first association agreement that the EU signs with a country outside of the actual membership conditionality process that has a conditionality component. In other words, Ukraine commits to implementing a list of rule of law and anti-corruption reforms in order to speed up the process of European integration. And in that period, in the post-Euromaidan period, we see significant progress in Ukraine on these political dimensions, as we see the adoption of a full institutional architecture of different types of institutions that are trying to increase accountability, transparency, and go after entrenched political corruption. And that's why we see in that period an increase in Ukraine's scores in terms of the ability to tackle corruption, and in terms of sort of moving towards a more mature democratic competition. And after the full scale invasion, and this is the what I'm showing you on the map, type of, I don't know if it's on your left or on your right on the map. Here we see that after the full-scale invasion of 2022, it's really now clear for the vast majority of Ukrainians that the choice is between Russia's, the choice that they're facing is between Russia's autocracy and a democratic regime. So we see upwards of 90% in all of the regions of Ukraine expressing strong commitment that for them, it is very important that Ukraine become a fully functional, well-functioning democracy. Now, let me last talk about the geopolitical divergence. And what we trace in the book is that the geopolitical divergence actually happens much later, after the divergence on identity and on regime type. In fact, for very all the way through the 90s and 2000s, all the way up to Euromaidan, we do not have in Ukraine a majority commitment to NATO membership, nor do we have a very clear and overwhelming commitment to EU membership. In fact, Ukrainians are kind of ambivalent about the whole, about the geopolitical aspect of things. And it's only after Russia's aggression in 2013 that we see majorities of Ukrainians think, well, we probably need to reorient towards Europe decisively in order to safeguard our statehood. And at the elite level, there was some understanding of this even earlier. So we know that Yushchenko pushed very hard for both NATO membership and for EU membership, but he was rebuffed by both the EU and NATO. And it's really important here to keep in mind that Russia knew quite well that Ukraine is being rebuffed. So, for example, in 2008, the year of the Bucharest Memorandum, the infamous Bucharest Memorandum, where Ukraine is offered almost unilaterally by George Bush, really, this open-ended, because we know that France and Germany were against it, this open-ended, vague promise to become a NATO member someday. And this is discussed a lot today as some sort of deep reason for the war. But the fact is that the Russian government understood very well that this is an empty, vague promise. And in 2008, we have Foreign Minister Lavrov, when asked about what are the main problems in Russia-Ukraine relations, he does not give NATO as an example. He says the main problems in Russia-Ukraine relations are Ukraine's language policies and historical memory policies. So it illustrates that the identity and regime divergence were really much more important to Russia and much more triggering Russia's commitment to tie Ukraine back to itself, to bring it back into the fold of the Russian world than any geopolitical divergence was. And indeed, even after Euromaidan, Ukrainians maintained the idea that they would be able to have a friendly relationship with Russia. So the idea that Ukraine became anti-Russia is a Russian perception and not at all a perception of Ukrainians of themselves and their country. So we have on this graph the answers to the question of what should be the relationship between Ukraine and Russia. And this question has been asked consistently in Ukraine since 1993. And you see in the beginning that there's a significant proportion who want to be in a common state with Russia. Now that drops off very quickly and becomes a non-issue by basically after the Orange Revolution. It becomes a very marginal position. But what remains a very dominant position is this idea, this is the blue line that you have on top, this idea that Russia and Ukraine will be two independent countries, but they're going to have a special friendly relationship with each other. And for the entire period, this is the dominant position in Ukraine. The light green line is the proportion of people who think that Ukraine and Russia should be two independent states, no special relationship, same relationship between Ukraine and Russia as Ukraine and France. You know, nothing super special. Now, that's a minority position for a lot of the period. Ukrainians overwhelmingly want a friendly relationship in Russia with Russia. Even after the aggression of 2014, still significant proportion of Ukrainians want to maintain friendly relations with Russia. They consider this the beginning of this aggression sort of, they blame this on the Putin regime, but they think that in the long haul, friendly relationship will be possible. Only after the full-scale invasion do we see the dramatic geopolitical divergence, where now 79% of Ukrainians think that the relationship, the special relationship between Ukraine and Russia is over. They want nothing to do with Russia anymore, just a neighbor. But that's it, nothing special. So the point here is that the geopolitical divergence that we see is the result of the war that's been going on since 2014, rather than the cause of it. And so let me briefly go over a couple of alternative explanations here and some counterfactuals, which we discuss in the book quite extensively in different chapters. The first alternative explanation, which you're probably familiar with, is the idea that NATO expansion caused Russia to invade Ukraine. And that's alternative explanation has both a stronger version and a weaker version. The stronger version is that Russia was simply afraid of NATO expanding to its borders. It was a security threat to Russia that Russia sought to minimize. Now, this strong version of the argument has been falsified by events after 22. Why? Because after 22, after Russia invaded a non-NATO member, Ukraine, which was not even close to being a NATO member, it's even today not invited to be a NATO member. After Russia invaded a non-NATO member, NATO expanded by adding Finland. It's now in the process of adding Sweden too. It expanded to Finland, and Finland has a border with Russia. Now there is a bigger part of NATO on Russia's borders, and Russia has not only not invaded Finland to prevent that, but it also has pulled away its military forces from the Finnish border, meaning that it has showed through its actions that it's actually not concerned about a NATO invasion. So it has pulled away from the NATO border, its military from the NATO border, in order to continue attacking a non-NATO member. So the strong version of the argument absolutely doesn't work. The weaker version of the argument is a bit more, has more meat to it. And that's the version that Russia wants to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO because of it wants to safeguard its sphere of influence. It wants to be able to dominate Ukraine geopolitically and decide its military alliances. But that's really the only reason why we see this invasion. And although this is true, that indeed Russia wants to control Ukraine's geopolitical orientation, it is insufficient for us to understanding the war. It's insufficient because Russia also wants to control a lot more than Ukraine's geopolitical orientation. As I've explained, and as we show in the book, Russia wants to control Ukraine's domestic politics. It wants to control its citizenship politics, policies, its historical memory policies, its language policies. It has opinions on how Ukrainians identify themselves, how they talk about their history, and how they govern themselves. So controlling Ukraine geopolitically is just woefully insufficient for Russia. It wants a lot more. And second of all, it's not even a necessary condition for this war, because NATO was in fact not anywhere close to inviting Ukraine to join. And the two points at which Russia invaded Ukraine, first in 2014 and then in 22, do not coincide with any move by Ukraine towards NATO or any move by NATO towards Ukraine. In 2014, clearly the trigger is a domestic political outcome in Ukraine, which is the Euromaidan. And what follows are some changes in how Ukraine was going to govern itself. The Ukrainian, the new Ukrainian government very clearly pointed out that they're not in any way going to be moving towards NATO. They're just not part of that moment at all. In 22, between 2014 and 22, we have very modest Western aid to Ukraine. We have a West that is very cognizant of Russia's sensitivity in this area. So the military aid to Ukraine is minimal. The West encourages Ukraine not to fight for Crimea. So it's very difficult to actually buy the argument that Russia was mainly concerned about Ukraine joining NATO. The second alternative explanation is that there was the first Russian intervention is really and the full scale invasion later on is really caused by Russia intervening to protect the rights of Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine. But the problem with that explanation is that has to do with the interpretation of what the Minsk process was actually doing. And as we show in the book, the Minsk process And the war in Donbass, ironically, was not really about control of Donbass. It was a way for Russia to actually control the central Ukrainian government by having these proxies in these separatists that were had very close relationship to Russia with giving them a veto power over central Ukrainian government policies. And so in addition, sort of the fact that this war has now largely destroyed precisely the Russian-speaking communities, the predominantly Russian-speaking communities in Ukraine, is a sign that Russia is not truly trying to defend them. The fact that now in the occupied territories we have resistance by the local population and all sorts of repressive policies by Russia to clamp down on this resistance also shows that this was not a welcome move by that population on the part of Russia. I can talk more about that in the Q&A if you're interested. I see that I'm really kind of running out of time. Finally, I'll very briefly talk about two counterfactuals that we discuss at length in the book. The first one is whether this divergence between Russia and Ukraine was inevitable. And we argue that it was not inevitable. There were different ways in which this divergence could have been bridged and the collision course would have been avoided. The first one I already mentioned, possibilities for Ukraine's democratic regime breaking down, Ukraine becoming an autocracy, which would have led to much better relations with autocratic Russia, and hence no collision course. The other counterfactual, though, is the possibility of Russia, of political competition surviving in Russia. And if political competition, which is possible, if political competition had survived in Russia beyond the early mid-90s, then we would have seen a situation in which Russia is still trying to tie Ukraine back to itself. But the debate within Russia over the ways of doing it would have been vibrant. And as a result, we would have been less likely to see a military aggression. We would have more likely seen debate over what the best way to do it is. In the 90s, for example, there were some in the Russian liberal circles that were talking about a liberal empire, where Russia would become this really attractive model. And so all the former Soviet states would gravitate towards it and want to reintegrate just because Russia would be an amazing model for them. You know, maybe they might have taken steps towards that that becoming a reality. So it's definitely a contingent story that that has to do with how things developed over time, rather than some sort of predetermined outcome, you know, a war with a ticking time bomb with a 30-year ticking mechanism. That's not what this was. This was a gradual, slow process. And finally, we go over the counterfactual of whether a different Western policy could have changed this trajectory and could have avoided the collision course. And we say that, yes, perhaps a different policy may have made a difference, but it's not the type of policy that you've heard of, no NATO expansion, because without NATO expansion, nothing would have been solved in the Russia-Ukraine relationship, where Russia wanted to control Ukrainian domestic policies. The only thing that would have happened from non-NATO expansion was that a bigger proportion of post-Soviet states, the Baltics, for example, or Eastern Europe, would have been left unprotected from Russian potential Russian expansionism, and would have been insecure and would have probably looked for a ways to launch their own regional alliances alliances against Russia. I mean, it's important to remember that NATO expanded not because the US wanted to, but because the Baltics and the Central Europeans were constantly begging for it from the very start, very strongly advocating for themselves to become members of NATO, because specifically because they were concerned about Russian expansionism returning fairly quickly. And so the way in which Western policy could have helped is not by not expanding NATO, but it could have helped if in 2014 the West had recognized that Crimea, the taking of Crimea, is not a one-off. It's not because there is something extra special about Crimea. It's really because the Putin regime is interested in re-litigating history, in capturing or recapturing territories that Putin sees as historically belonging to Russia. I mean, it's no surprise that that's what he talked about in the Tucker Carlson interview ad nauseum. And so if the West had recognized the potential for further invasion of Ukraine, they could have put in more efforts into deterrence. And arming Ukraine earlier could have acted as a deterrence for Putin. I mean, we see that for all of his historical obsession, he does react rationally to developments on the battlefield. If he's beaten on the battlefield, as it happened in Kharkiv, in Kherson, the Russian army withdraws. So it is likely that if Ukraine had better capabilities after 2014, they may have deterred the full-scale invasion in 22. And this is how we think that a different Western policy may have potentially changed the trajectory of this war. And I'll end here.
Great. Thank you very much, Maria. That was all really very interesting. So as Peter said at the beginning, we're now going to give the floor for a few minutes to a special guest, Andrei Kamenchikov. As Peter said, he's the Ukraine representative for the U.S.-based NGO Nonviolence International and the East European Regional Coordinator for an international civil society network called the Global Partnership for the Prevention of Armed Conflict. So, Mr. Kamenchikov.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity, and thank Ms. Popova for this beautiful explanation of the situation. And very many points that were raised and explained right now are points that I also constantly focus on explaining the situation in Ukraine today. I just would like to make one very little correction. In fact, the president of Belarus did lose presidential elections in 2020, but was able to maintain himself in power by using force against his political opposition. So there's this one little correction.
Good correction. Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah. And I have just a few minutes. So one thing that I would like to speak about, I'm for over 30 years, I've been working as a civil society activist, a peace builder in the different parts of the post-Soviet world. And actually, most of that time, I lived in Russia myself, as long as that was possible. And then I moved from Moscow to Kiev in about 8 or 9 years ago. And so I do live in Kiev now, visiting here, and I'm still trying to find ways in which, besides the support that is given to Ukraine today, military economic support, which I do endorse as well, and that is important for Ukraine, I think that there are also ways to support the Ukrainian cause through nonviolent means as well. And also, what I think is very important today, too, is and would be a benefit for Ukraine, is to focus and really more critically assess the possibilities of working with Russian society itself. As we know, you know, just recently there was this tragedy where the Russian opposition leader, extremely courageous guy, was murdered. And I am absolutely 100% sure that he was murdered only by the direct orders of Mr. Putin. No one else could make that kind of decision. And I think that there are, I've been doing some, let's say, informal research in Russian society due to my contacts there and my previous experience. I know that there is a lot that can be done by engaging in Russian society, especially the groups in Russian society that are that more or less understand what is happening. And also by working with the probably about a million people, Russian citizens, who left the country over the last couple of years because of the internal policies and, of course, because of Putin's war against Ukraine. This is a potential because these people have the possibilities to communicate with their friends, their relatives who remain inside the country, and they could become a channel of communicating independent information into Russia. Unfortunately, today, the propaganda is so intense that for, I would say, about 70 to 80% of the population of Russia, it basically largely forms their ideas, their understanding of what is happening. Even if they don't agree with their policies, they often reiterate the different myths and stereotypes that are being imposed on them by propaganda. And as unfortunately we can also see, as I'm sure Mrs. Popova also has referred to, that many of the stereotypes that Russia has been promoting, they're popular not only in Russia itself, but they also find they also become accepted by many people in the West who don't know all these details. So thank you very much for your explanation and for focusing on this particular fact, that what is often seen as a response on the part, or what is often being portrayed by Russian propaganda as Russia's response to developments in Ukraine or to Western policies, in reality, it's the exact opposite. It's that I would say, and people joke, that probably nobody did more for a real independent Ukraine than Mr. Putin today. You know, if there was anyone that could do so much to really diverge the two societies, it's him personally and his regime. And so I urge you to support any kind of activities that are in support of Ukraine and that are also in support of changes in Russia itself that would definitely also affect and would help put an end to this terrible and bloody war that we all witnessed today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have time to do some Q&A. And if you have a question for Dr. Popova, please raise your hand. We'll bring a microphone to you.
Yeah, my question for Dr. Popova concerns the correlation that you noted between the rise of primary identification as the Ukrainian state with a change from being predominantly Ukrainian-speaking to Russian-speaking. Anecdotally, it has seemed to me, and I'm a very casual observer of the situation, there is a noteworthy community in Ukraine that is predominantly Russian-speaking but aligned with the Zelensky government and the resistance to the full-scale invasion. Could you is there such a phenomenon, and what are the characteristics of these people, these Russian speakers but Ukrainian statehood aligned Ukrainians?
In fact, the important thing to understand is that being a Russian speaker does not make you a non-Ukrainian, right? So Zelensky himself is now speaking Ukrainian much more, but is one of those Russian speakers. And so language has over time become less and less important as a predictor of political attitudes of any kind. Basically, the Russian-speaking community is just as committed to repelling the Russian invasion as those who choose to predominantly speak Ukrainian.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for your interesting talk. So I didn't really hear you talk about the identity conflicts between the countries, but you didn't really talk about the maritime aspect of the conflict. So not only with respect to the delimitation in the Sea of Azov, the Kerch Strait Bridge, also the basing rights, right? So Ukraine at various points in time tried increasing the cost of naval basing, and then Russia would retaliate with raising energy costs or cutting off energy supplies. And so I'm wondering, to what extent do you think maritime access to the Black Sea and the naval rights and those issues affected the overall relationship?
That's an interesting point. I mean, it is a fact that Ukraine had given Russia a lease to keep their Black Sea fleet in Ukrainian waters and ports, and at no point was that lease under threat, really. When you talk about the Kerch Strait, the first thing that comes to mind is actually the Tuzla incident in 2003. And that's when we have in Ukraine a pro-Russian president, President Kuchma, good relationship between Russia and Ukraine in geopolitical terms, both moving sort of in the same direction geopolitically. At that point, Russia is not anti-Western. And we have in 2003, Russia started building a dam on the Tuzla Island, which is an island that belonged to Ukraine, according to international law. It's an island in the Kerch Strait. And Russia unilaterally started building this dam. That caused, of course, high concern for the Ukrainian government. And the pro-Russian president, Kuchma, including some of his ministers, very known as pro-Russian politicians, responded militarily to defend Ukrainian territorial integrity. And they had a military exercise in the sea there to show that they will defend this island. And Kuchma went to Moscow, and he gave an interview to the main Russian newspaper, and he said, "You gotta understand, the more you build this dam, the more we look to the West for protection." So indeed, this sort of dance between Russia trying to sort of tie Ukraine back to itself and Ukraine's attempts to resist this tying and to pursue a multi-vector policy. I mean, it's interesting because now some people say, why can't Ukraine be a buffer? Well, Ukraine tried to be a buffer for all that period. It did not work because Russia wanted Ukraine to be more than a buffer, but rather a vassal.
Actually, I have two questions. The first one is, you talk a lot about identity of statehood, nationalism. You did not mention the political gain. I'd like to know if there's economic motivation for Russia to annex Ukraine. That's my first question. The second question is, at the time during collapse of Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact was resolved. And if at the same time NATO was also resolved, would that bring in more peace or not?
The economic argument is maybe another sort of potentially alternative story here, but it doesn't seem that that's driving a lot of things, because basically Russia had a lot of economic levers on Ukraine already. So it's not really, I mean, it's difficult to understand why they would need to annex the country in order to take full advantage of it. They already had significant levers, which they undermined really through the identity policies and through the political sort of pressure. In terms of the counterfactual of what if NATO had dissolved, I mean, the reality is if NATO had dissolved, this security vacuum would have been filled by something. And what we know from the foreign policy statements of especially the Eastern Europeans in that period is that they would have formed an alternative alliance to protect themselves from potentially re-expansionist Russia. So it's not a magic solution, because you cannot Gorbachev had started building trust in Eastern Europe, but you got to remember that these were really just a few short years. And after these countries managed to finally break out of the Soviet sphere of influence, a lot of them would have tried to protect themselves from reincorporation.
Okay, Bill, back to you.
Okay, well, I guess unfortunately we're going to have to wrap up. Thank you very much, Maria. That was really an excellent program. If you enjoyed this free program, the refreshments provided, or the opportunity to connect around important international topics with in-person and virtual experts, please consider supporting our mission to help Iowans better understand international issues and foster global engagement. Once more, thank you to the members of our community and to the Iowa City Public Library for their enduring backing. Our next program features speaker Dr. Kathleen Kunast from the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., who will speak on Why Women Peace Builders Matter. Join us from 12 to 1 p.m. on Friday, the 8th of March, here in the Public Library and online, where in recognition of International Women's Day, our speaker will discuss gender-inclusive peacebuilding and present the work of the U.S. Institute for Peace's 2023 Women Building Peace Award finalists. According to Dr. Kunast, research confirms that the security of a nation is directly tied to the security and status of its women. At the same time, violent conflict upends and polarizes societies, disrupting social structures and gender roles. An expanding evidence base indicates that the peacebuilding and security programs and policies are more successful when they address the different impacts of conflicts on men, women, and gender and sexual minorities, and ensure full participation of diverse women in the design and implementation of solutions. So with that, thank you again for joining us today, everyone. We are adjourned.